going to move into Olympia study. Hopefully, you have an outline that has the parallel passages for Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Anyone not have one of these? You got one? Good. The book that's going to be relevant to what I'm going to cover now is called The Footsteps of the Messiah, subtitled A Study of the Sequence of Prophetic Events. It covers all of the prophetic scriptures in both testaments, but puts the prophecies in chronological sequence. You can tell in what order these prophecies will be fulfilled. A number of appendices, one of these appendices, the Alpha Discourse, so what we're going to cover now is one of the appendices in the back of the book that you can therefore follow. Just for a couple of minutes, open your Bibles to Matthew 23. I want to just give you some of the background before we get into Matthew 24, and then you can just use these pages. We come to Matthew 23. It is with this chapter that he closes public ministry. And he closes it 3 years after it began. It began at Passover time, but not close to Passover time. What he does, he closes public ministry with a renunciation or denunciation of the Pharisees and Pharisaic Judaism. They put out 7 different woes upon the Pharisees, and while they're variety different sins, they form a circle, because the first woe and then the second woe deal with the very same sin. It comes to a close in Matthew chapter 23, verses 37 to 39. He summarizes his 3-year ministry to Israel. So in verse 37, he laments, he's unable to give Jerusalem the messianic protection predicted by the prophets, because he would not only Greek, they willed it not when they rejected him. And so the house in verse 38, the house reference to the temple, will lie desolate, be destroyed 40 years hence. What he does in verse 39 is to lay down the precondition to the second coming. Present, you shall not see me henceforth, and you shall say, is again the precondition to the second coming, and they cry out, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. One of the key differences between the rapture and the church and the second coming is right here. The rapture of the church has no preconditions whatsoever. It can happen any moment of time. Could even come today. And that's part of God's program for the body of the Messiah, the church. Well, the second coming is part of God's program for Israel. So he left Israel because of their rejection. He will not come back to Israel to accept him. And so the two key elements involved in the precondition of the second coming is, first of all, they must confess the national sin of rejecting him on the grounds of being demonized, and then secondly, to plead for the Messiah to return, to mourn for him as one mourns for his son. Until these two things occur, there'll be no second coming. Now, this is something Satan is aware of. And once we understand the precondition to the return, we'll see, understand the biblical foundations of anti-Semitism, how Satan has had this continuous, unending war against the Jewish people. He knows that once the Messiah returns, his career is over, but also knows that He won't come back, but the Jews ask him to come back, so they can annihilate the Jews before the chest of plead for Messiah's return, there will be no second coming. And Satan's crow is said, brother. That's why he's always had this war against the Jews. That's why things like the Crusades occurred. That's why things like the Russian programs occurred. That's why the Nazi Holocaust occurred. And that's why in Revelation 12, when Satan is confined to the earth for the second half of the tribulation, says he knows this time is short. Only 3.5 years before the second coming. And if this time is short, he uses all of his satanic energies to try to wipe out the Jews once and for all. And so Satan's goal will be to annihilate the Jews but to avoid the second coming. And that's why you'll see that war emphasizing over and over again. So let's not pick up your outlines. I've divided the element discourse into 14 divisions. Begins with the story of Sadek. He's now leaving the temple compound for the last time. And as he's leaving it, interesting references to Luke Rousseau and so on, I'll always read the third column. So Luke verse 5 points out, as they left, the disciples pointed out to the Messiah about the massive stones that made up the temple compound, adorned with goodly stones and offerings. And up until this point, this was the largest stones ever used in any construction in the land of Israel. If you look at the end of Mark's account, verse 1, what manner of stones, what manner of buildings? And some of these stones, 10 to 12 feet, most of them about length, but some of those are much, much larger, weighing tons, and nobody's sure exactly how they're able to get these stones on top of another range in equipment. I wanted to point out the magnificence of this temple building, which wasn't even finished at this stage. Herod the Great began a whole remodeling of the temple compound in 20 BC. The first thing he did was reconstruct the temple. The temple was fully finished. Many other buildings were still in the process of being built when these events occurred. They were not finished until the year AD 64. Altogether, it took 84 years to get everything done. And yet the Messiah says at the end of Matthew verse 2, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And describes a massive destruction of the temple compound, there will be not one stone on top of another. This was quite literally fulfilled in the year 70 because Titus, the general who took over the siege of Jerusalem and Vespasian went to Rome to become the emperor. And while the temple walls were overlaid with gold, they were covered by wool coverings. And Titus told the soldiers, leave the temple alone, do not harm it. But in the heat of fighting, one soldier took a torch and threw it inside the first room. And the curtains began to burn up, and the gold began to melt and seep in within the stones. So when everything pulled out, they wished to get to the gold, they took one stone off the top of the other. So it was quite literally fulfilled. And that raises in section 2 to 3 questions. They cross over the Kidron Valley, they ascend the Mount of Olives, that's why it's called the Olivet Discourse. It was spoken of on the Mount of Olives. And the disciples come to raise a specific 3 questions. Now Matthew looks simply to success disciples in general, but Mark is a bit more specific. 4 disciples, 2 sets of brothers raised the questions, Peter and James and John and Andrew. And in verse 4, or rather in verse 3 of Matthew, verse 4 of Matthew's account, tell us when shall these things be? And in the same to these things, this is prophecy in verses 1 and 2. And Luke provides us with a slightly longer version of the first question in verse 7 of Luke. When therefore shall these things be, and what shall be the sign when these things are about to come to pass? And that's a longer version of the first question. The first question is, what is the sign that Jerusalem, the temple, about to be destroyed? Secondly, what is the sign of your coming? They're not thinking about the second coming because they do not understand that as yet. In previous passages, he spelled out the program of death and resurrection. At least four times we have recorded in his Gospels, giving out the details each time. However, in the Gospels, they always made it clear they did not understand what he was saying, so when these things did happen, they caught him by surprise. So they're asking the question from what they at this point understand, what will be the sign of your coming for the purpose of setting up the Messianic kingdom? And the third question is, what is the sign of the end of the world, more correct, the end of the age? And remember, they're thinking in terms of the rabbinic eschatology in their day, which only had two time zones. This age, the age in which you now live, and the age to come, which is the Messianic age, the Messianic kingdom. So what is the sign that this age has begun to end, which will give way to the new age, the Messianic kingdom? That's where they're coming from, and at that point that they now understand. Now, when Jesus answers the questions, he'll answer it from his own perspective because he knows what's going to be in the future, but he's told them what's going to happen in the future, but they do not yet understand that. The question they're asking is simply, what shall be the sign the temple and the city will be destroyed? What is the sign of your coming for this purpose? And what is the sign that the end of this age has begun? So the elephant discusses he will answer all three questions, but not in the same order they were asked. He'll answer the third question first. What's the sign that the end of the age has begun? The third question first, the first question second, and the second question third. That'll be the order in which these questions will be answered. So go to the next page on this outline. In dealing with the answer to the third question, what's the sign that the end of the age has begun? He'll begin to answer the question negatively, pointing out two things which is not a sign of the last days, and then the one thing which is a sign of the last days. So under point three, the general characteristics of the age between the two comings. And these are two things that will characterize the whole age, and either one will point out as a sign the last days have begun. So in verse 5, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am the Messiah, and shall lead many astray. So one characteristic is the rise of many false messiahs. The first one in Jewish history to claim to be the Messiah was Yeshua, was Jesus. He's the first one to make that claim. It's not a century later, in the year 132 AD, a man named Simon Bar Kokhba led the second revolt against Rome. And for a year and a half, he won every fight. Every Roman legion that was sent against him was defeated. For the halfway point of the revolt, and Jewish leaders did participate in the second revolt, Rabbi Akiva, who was then the leading rabbi of the day, convinced the Sanhedrin to declare Simon Bar Kokhba to be the Messiah. And the Sanhedrin followed his lead. He changed the name of Kokhba to Kachba. So now it's no longer Simon Bar Kokhba, but Simon Bar Kachba, which means the son of the star. Going back to the prophecy of Balaam, a star will rise out of Jacob, to whom the obedience of the Gentiles will be given. So now the banner of the second of all changed, and that was under the Messianic banner, and that the Messianic Jews of that day could no longer participate, so they withdrew from the world. They're going to fight the Simon claiming to be the Messiah. As a result of that acclamation, he began losing battle after battle. He was finally forced to withdraw from Jerusalem. He made last stand a few months away at the city of Beit Tar, province of Aram, and he was killed. And there's a long line of false messiahs. The last false messiah in Jerusalem was a man named Jacob Frank of Poland in the 1700s or the 1800s, but the most significant false messiah was a man named Shabtai Tzvi in the 1600s. And he had a large following, both east and west. He declared he will now go to Istanbul, because Turkey now controlled the land of Israel, and he will demand from the leader of the Turkish Empire to give the land to the Jews. Well, he got to Istanbul, he got arrested, and he was given a choice. You can continue your claim and you'll have to execute you, or you can choose to convert to Islam. He chose to convert to Islam. And that kind of ended that movement. Among Gentiles, we also had periodically the rise of false messiahs. The most famous recent one is a man who's now passed away, Reverend Moon, from South Korea. He claimed to be the second coming of the Messiah, also a large following both east and west. As other false messiahs, Reverend Moon eventually underwent his own lunar eclipse and disappeared from the scene. And then the second thing that characterized the so-called of old age period, is in the next verse. You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. So the whole age will be characterized by conflict here, conflict there. And too many Christians often assume there's a conflict in the Middle East that must be somehow significant. Maybe it could be politically significant or politically significant. It's not necessarily politically significant. And so, for example, when the first Gulf crisis broke out with the first President Bush, several books came out trying to prove it's a fulfillment of prophecy. Five or six books came out saying that this shows this fulfillment. The trouble is that Bible never prophesied the war between Iraq and America. When the second Bush became president, there was less excitement along those lines, but kind of books that came back. Now, when President Bush was first elected, there was a lot of fear and trepidation in Israel, a lot of fear. Because the last time the Jews listened to someone by the name of Bush, they got lost in the desert for 40 years. The burning bush. And so on. But for these things, notice what he says at the end of verse 6. For these things must needs come to pass, but what? But the end is not yet. Otherwise, none of these things are signs that the last days of this age has begun. But now the section where he provides the positive answer, the sign of the end of the age. In Matthew verse 7, for nation shall rise up against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There shall be famine and earthquakes in diverse places, but all these things are the beginning of travail. The word travail is the Greek word for birth pain. It refers to a series of birth pains one undergoes before giving birth to a baby. It points out the last days of this age will be a series of travails, series of birth pains, before the birth of the new Messianic age. But in this verse, he's not talking about birth pangs in general, but the first birth pang, Dnešný piesnešný piesnešný by says, this is the beginning of Growth Bank. This is the first Growth Bank. And that is somehow different than Walser Whistle Wars. Walser Whistle Wars, local wars here and there, were characterized as all age, the other side of the end. But when you see a world, and a, but when you see nation against nation, against kingdom, that is the first growth bank. That's the sign that the end has begun. And often in popular prophecy books, when people talk about this being the last days, they often give signs, as is most of these prophecy writers tend to be American, they write how these events affect American history. And it's very hard for Americans to accept that God did not consider the USA important enough to mention anywhere in the Bible, not even Bible prophecy. It plays no mentioned role in Bible prophecy. And to judge where we are in the areas of prophecy, how do world events affect Jewish history and the history of Israel? That was the sign. Now, Washington, D.C. is not the holy city. Never was, and especially is not now. And so this is not the, you cannot judge what the Americans do about how things affect the Americans, America. It's about things that affect Jewish history. So what is nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom? It was already an idiom, a rabbinic idiom for world war. So when you see a world war, in contrast to local wars, that's the sign that the end has begun. Now, how did they arrive at this conclusion? I take your Bibles and turn to Isaiah chapter 19. Isaiah chapter 19. In the Hebrew Bible, the phrase nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom, or city against city, was used describing total conflict in the area of the context. Total conflict in the area of the context. In the context of Isaiah chapter 19 is Egypt. And verse 1 reads, the burden of Egypt. Behold, Jehovah rides upon a swift cloud and comes unto Egypt, and the eyes of Egypt shall tremble at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. I'll raise up the Egyptians against the Egyptians. They shall fight everyone against his brother, everyone against his neighbor, and then lowest, city against city, and kingdom against kingdom. This idiom is describing total conflict, total chaos, anarchy in the land of Egypt. Divided into civil war, anarchy, and things of that nature. Now, for example, go to 2 Chronicles chapter 15. 2 Chronicles chapter 15. Now the context here is the nations of the Middle East. The nations of the Middle East. And we'll pick up our reading in chapter 15 of 2 Chronicles, verse 3. Verse 3, now for a long time, for a long season, Israel was without the true God, and without a teaching priest, and without law. And when in their distress they turned unto Jehovah the God of Israel, and sought him, he was found of them. In those times there was no peace, him that went out or him that came in. But great vexations were upon all the inhabitants of the lands, plural. And they were broken to pieces, nation against nation, and city against city. For God avenged them with all adversity. So now the context, with this context, the Middle East describes anarchy, conflict among all the nations of the Middle East. So is it unsafe to go into a house, out of a house, and so on? So you come to the time of first century Judaism. The rabbis used that term to describe a worldwide conflict. Gospels, the focus here is on the world. For example, in Matthew's Gospel, the word world will be mentioned in verses 14, 21, 30, 31, and 35. In Mark's Gospel, in verse 27 and 31. In Luke's Gospel, verses 26, 33, 35. 26, 33, 35. And so I would agree that we have entered the last days, but I would not begin it with some other reasons often given. Understanding the Jewish frame of reference, nation against nation, against kingdom, the First World War, it was the opening travail from the years 1914 to 1918. And for all practical reasons, the Second World War was the continuation of the First World War from 1939 to 1945. And both World Wars had a decisive impact on Jewish history. The events of World War I that gave impetus to the rise of Zionism and the growth of Zionism. The movement began in the 1890s, but the actual massive growth of Zionism was a result of World War I and results of World War II and the Nazi Holocaust set the stage for the reestablishment of the Jewish state. He points out it'll be coupled with famines and earthquakes. In 1920, there was the Great Chinese Famine, followed in 1921 by the Great Russian Famine. As far as earthquakes, in the years before, during, and shortly after World War I, and many others, one of them here, all of them. So, for example, in 1905, India, 20,000 died. 1908, Italy, 35,000 died. 1915, Italy, 30,000 died. 1920, China, 180,000 died. 1923, Japan, 143,000 died. And so on. And so what? So now he's answered the third question. What is the sign that the end of this age has begun? And that is when you see nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom, city against city, and then in a worldwide conflict. And in World War I, every nation was involved either directly or indirectly, except for southern countries. Every nation was involved either directly or indirectly, except for seven countries. So now we come to the next section, which is the personal experiences of the apostles. Normally, he gives a chronological sequence, but twice he will break away from the chronology. When he does do so, he'll tell us he's doing so. So look at Luke's account, verse 12. But before all these things, study note, who is about to say next segment, doesn't follow the world war, precedes the world war. There'll be two times he will do this. And so he now described that before the five, the last days has begun, what the apostles are going to experience up until the last one passes away. He mentioned nine things altogether. First of all, they should anticipate being rejected by the Jewish audience. I heard myself. Before we go into that, let me just quote you a couple of sources that might be on the screen. Our rabbinic writings that used that phrase of those times. There's one right there. And it reads, at the time war shall be stirred up in the world, Nation shall be against nation, city against city. Much distress shall be renewed against the enemies of the Israelites. That's one ancient source for that quotation. Another one, from Bereshit Rabbah. If when you shall see kingdom rise against each other, third, then give heed and know the footsteps of the Messiah. And I borrow the title for my prophecy from this rabbinic quotation. The footsteps of the Messiah refers to the series of steps leading up to the coming of the Messiah. And the book deals with the sequence of events about the prophecy. Okay, now back to the section 5. Luke tells us it's about to describe what happened before what he just described, but before all these things. So number one, there'll be widespread rejection by the Jewish community. So Mark says they'll be delivered up to councils and synagogues. But secondly, there'll be widespread rejection by the Gentile community. They'll be brought before governors and kings, and this will not have governors and kings under Roman authority. That shows they're rejected both by Jewish leaders and Gentile leaders. Thirdly, in Luke's account, verse 13, these times of persecution, whether the Jewish or Gentile persecution, provide opportunity for testimony. Fourthly, in Mark verse 10, they'll succeed in giving the gospel to be proclaimed everywhere. Indeed, Paul writes in Colossians 1, verse 6 and verse 23, Colossians 1, 6 and verse 23. The gospel has been proclaimed to all creation under heaven. Israel told them to expect widespread rejection by the Jewish and Gentile community. But that's going to get a bit more personal. At the fifth point he makes, they'll be given divine utterance when they are brought before courts of law. They don't have to figure out any specific defense. They'll be given the right things to say. The enemies cannot gainsay. That's in Luke's account, verse 14 and 15. But the first element comes out of in Mark's account, verse 12. They also be rejected by members of their own family. Not just Jews and Gentiles in general, but members of their own family. So suddenly, in Mark verse 13, they'll be hated by all. They'll be hated by all. And in fact, of these 11 men, 10 will die the deaths of a martyr. Only one man dies of old age, and that is John. He dies as an exile on Patmos, a small desert island on the west coast of modern-day Turkey. Now, while their physical security is not guaranteed, the point is that the spiritual security is guaranteed. And Luke verse 8 says that not a hair of your head shall perish. In the Vietnam War, many Christian mothers would take this verse out of context and apply it to their sons going to Vietnam. But you can't, once you pull the verse out of context, it becomes a pretext. And they don't bother reading the text, the verses before it. For example, in verse 16, some of you shall they first be put to death. And so verse 18 cannot be teaching physical security. He just told them they don't have physical security in this life. But they do have spiritual security. At night, in spite of all this opposition from Jews, Gentiles, and family members, they will win souls. Indeed, by the last apostle, the time the last apostle dies, congregations have been established everywhere, both inside and outside the Roman Empire. Look at the section 6, and now it will provide the answer to the first question, only one father to give us the answer. What's the sign that the Jerusalem and the temple are about to be destroyed? What is that sign? And the sign is in verse 20. But when you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know the desolation is at hand. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, that's the sign Jerusalem is about to be destroyed. She tells them, if you're in the city, get out of the city. If you're outside the city, don't go in. But in verse 21, then let them that are in Judah flee unto the mountain, that it does the best of earth to fall out. Let not them that the country unto therein, for these are days of vengeance. God's things which are written may be fulfilled. So the vengeance for the rejection of Messiah is what the city is going to suffer in the assembly, and therefore they should not participate in defending the city, simply abandon it. The way this prophecy was fulfilled is that the revolt against Rome broke out in the year AD 66. And the then Roman governor, whose name was Cestus, C-E-S-T-U-S, C-E-S-T-U-S, Gallus, G-A-L-L-U-S, G-A-L-L-U-S, he assumed this was a local revolt in Jerusalem. He brought legions up from Caesarea, which was the Roman capital of the country, and he besieged the city. And the Messianic community took that to be the sign that they need to abandon the city, for the city surrounded by Roman soldiers, they couldn't do so. But then, as it turned out, this was a much widespread revolt, and the supply line that Cestus Gallus had arranged for the supply line was being cut by Roman forces. So he was forced to lift the siege. And the city was free of the siege for almost 2 years, 66 to AD 68. And the Messianic community took that to be the opportunity. They abandoned the city. The Jerusalem church was at least 20,000 strong, maybe more than that, but that's the minimum. 20,000 strong. They were joined by Messianics from Judea, from Galilee, and even the Golan Heights. And they crossed the Jordan River to the city of Pella, P-E-L-L-A, P-E-L-L-A, and by so doing, we were able to escape the war zone. And then in the year 68, the Romans came back and re-besieged the city, and in the year 70, the city was finally destroyed. Now, altogether, according to Josephus, a total of 1,100,000 Jews were killed in that Jewish revolt. 97,000 were taken to slavery to work at various Roman building projects. But the Messianic community, because of they did put their faith in what was written in the book of Hebrews, did survive. Now verse 24, they shall fall by the edge of the sword, shall be led captive in Rome, and all the nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now I was in Jerusalem during the Six-Day War, still a student at the university. And I finished, during the war, and I was also finished my studies 2 months after the war ended. When I came back to America, a lot of churches were teaching the times of the Gentiles have ended, because the Jews are now in control of the biblical Jerusalem. But they didn't actually understand the nature of Jewish history. The times of the Gentiles began in the year 586 BC. When you have the last Davidic king removed from the throne, Zedekiah. And since then, there's little bit known the Davidic king under the Davidic throne. And the history of four Gentile empires controlling the land and the people. And tell the Gentiles in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, do not end until once again you have a Davidic king sitting upon the Davidic throne. And that won't happen until the second coming. But in between the time the Gentiles can have periods of temporary Jewish control, it happened in 1967 in the Six-Day War. That was the fourth time that Jews captured Jerusalem. The first time was in the first Jewish revolt from 66 to 70, but then it was lost. The second time was in the second Jewish revolt from 132 to 135. They began the rebuild of the temple. They never finished it, got to finish it, and again the Romans took control. Even before the first and second Jewish revolt, you had the Maccabean period from 165 plus 63 BC for a century, plus 3 years. 165 plus 63 BC. They had control and then lost it. So what happened in 1967 was the fourth Gentile or Jewish takeover. It's also temporary. Israel continued controlling sovereignty over the old city until the middle of the tribulation. As we shall see as we continue with the study, at the midpoint of the tribulation, the nation will collapse. There'll be one more forced exile from the land. And Revelation 11, verses 1 and 2, Revelation 11, verses 1 and 2 specifies that just once again fall under Gentile control for 3.5 years, the second half of the tribulation. So now is answered the third question and also the first question. Now the next question to answer is, what is the sign of your coming? What is the sign? We did not understand the second coming, but his answer is what will be the sign of the second coming. But it begins discussing point 7, the Great Tribulation, and small 8, the first half. He mentions 5 specific things. First of all, there will be the rise of many false prophets. But before that, this will be a time of tremendous persecution of the saints. As those of Revelation 6, verses 9 to 11, Revelation 6, 9 to 11. And secondly, the rise of many false prophets. Thirdly, there'll be the increase of sin because the restrainment of lawlessness would be removed. The restrainment of lawlessness would be removed. This is verified in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 6 and 7. 2 Thess. 2:6-7. Fourthly, the Jews who live to the end of the tribulation are the ones who survive both physically and spiritually. And fifthly, there'll be the preaching of the gospel of the kingdom throughout the world to all nations and to every land. This will be accomplished in Revelation chapter 7, verses 1 through 8. By means of the 144,000 Jews that preach the gospel throughout the world. And then what John sees in verses 9 to 17 of Revelation 7, 9 to 17, are myriads and myriads of Gentiles standing before the throne. And when he asks the question, who are these myriads of Gentiles before the throne of God? He does the notes, he's told by the angel. These are the many Gentiles who come out as believers from the Great Tribulation, for they wash their robes and make them white in the blood of the Lamb. I go on to the next page, he deals with the events of the second half. Moses provide the specific sign by which they entered the midpoint in the second half. In Matthew verse 15, when therefore you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet in the holy place, let him that reads understand. Now, what is the abomination specifically involves several elements. It's first mentioned in Daniel 9, verse 27. Daniel 9, verse 27, which introduces the abomination of desolation. It doesn't specify what it is, but the word abomination is a term often used of idolatry. The second time it's mentioned will be in Daniel chapter 12. Verses 11 through 13, Daniel 12, 11 through 13, where he points out the abomination will be allowed to continue for 1,290 days. So keep in mind the second half of the tribulation is 1,260 days. The abomination will continue for 30 extra days, 1,290 days. Doesn't say what it is, but something standing, something erected, like an image would be. And then the next passage is Revelation 11, verses 1 and 2. That happens in connection with the Gentile retaking of the temple compound. And this passage, verse 15, is a sign for the Jews to flee the land. It's a sign for the Jews to flee the land. And what the abomination is involves two things. First of all, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3 and 4, 2 Thess 2, verse 3 and 4, it says the Antichrist will sit in the temple of God, setting himself forth as God. And when he's in the temple, he proclaims himself to be God Almighty, call upon the whole world to worship him as God, and to signify their acceptance of his deity by taking his mark of 666. That's the initial stage. He does the stage of slowly. He makes the rebuilt city of Babylon his world political and economic capital of the world. So then we come to the second stage, which is detailed in Revelation 13, verses 11 through 18. Revelation 13, 11 through 18. That the rise of the false prophet will make an image of the Antichrist, and that image will be set up in the Holy of Holies of the temple. That image is given the power both to speak and to kill, and that image will be allowed to stay in that temple for 1,290 days. So starting point of the second tribulation, the abomination of desolation. That's the first of specific things to note. Then secondly, it's a sign for the Jews to flee. So verse 16, let them Judea flee unto the mountain that is as in the hostile, now go down to take out the food from his house, then that is in the field, now return back to take his cloak. That emphasizes the speed and haste by which they need to flee. If they happen to be on the rooftop for any reason when they hear this event, they should come off the roof and inside the house to take any possessions. As soon as their foot touches the ground, make your way out of the country. Or if you're out playing in the field and you hear this event happening, don't go back to living quarters or the kibbutz quarters to take so much as a cloak. But when you drop that plow, make your way out of the country. At this point, worldwide anti-Semitism is about to break out. And Satan's goal in the second tribulation is to annihilate every Jew anywhere in the world to avoid the second coming. So the third point it goes. Before moving to the third point, other elements involved in the difficulty of escaping is in verse 19, women with male stages of pregnancy and having to carry babies in their arms, it'll be more difficult to escape as quickly as necessary. And in verse 22, paragraph servers, but this does not happen either in the winter nor in the Sabbath day. Why not in winter? Because Israel is a different pattern, has a very fixed pattern in the rain season. The rains begin to fall at the end of October. Rains will fall in November, December, January, February, begin to peter out in March and die out by mid-April. So mid-April to mid-October, no rain falls. One of the differences here in the West, we build a highway and come to a water gully. Even if it's a dry water gully, we tend to build a bridge across it. Not so in Israel, where the roads were paved into water gullies and not out again. Now, these water gullies are known as wadis, W-A-D-I. A wadi is dry all summer. It's dry most of winter, but when the rains fall in the mountain ranges of Israel, the water begins rushing down these wadis, can once it, but tons of rock and debris often destroying these highways. And so often I'm looking at Israel and driving around Israel, I sometimes have to make a major detour to go back where I came from because the wadi destroyed the highway just that way. Israelis like to hike these wadis, many of the picture of us look at miniature Grand Canyons, and often hiking right into the fall months, not realizing the rain season has begun. It may not be raining with the hiking, but it's raining elsewhere of the mountain ranges, and suddenly the water comes down. So every fall, I would see one Hebrew newspaper, one news newspaper, a news magazine from Israel, and every fall, the reports of Israelis killed that way. So pray that should light be not a winter. How dangerous could be is something that happened when I was a student at the university. This was 1966, and 40 French tourists were heading down a wadi to an archaeological site. And here again, it wasn't raining when they were walking, but they began to run elsewhere. All of a sudden, all this water came down, and within 30 minutes, 38 of these 40 French tourists all drowned. So pray that your flight be not a winter. Well, not on the Sabbath day, because on the Sabbath day, public transportation closes down from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday. Unless you have your automobile, this will make it difficult for you to escape. So the event itself will happen, but with the prayer request is now that it not happen in either in the winter or on the Sabbath day. His fourth point is in verse 22 of Matthew, regardless of bad it gets, Israel will survive. Except those days have been shortened, no flesh will be saved, for life's sake those days shall be shortened. Now, the word the text does not mean will be less than 7 years long, because the text is too specific, 1,260, the first half, 1,260 days, the second half. But the meaning of the actual text is will be suddenly cut short, not will be shorter. Be suddenly cut short, won't be allowed to continue for 1 second beyond the last 1,260 a day. If it continued any longer, the Jews might be destroyed. Thirdly, he points out there'll be again the rise of the false prophets and false messiahs. First of all, 50 false messiahs, 1591. She says, did you hear a rumor? The Messiah has returned, he is here, he's come back, he's there. Don't believe it and don't come out of hiding. Just stay hidden. Also, be the rise of false prophets. This is in connection with what he said already in the first half. The difference is this, the false prophets in the first half could not did false prophecies, but they did no signs or wonders. But the false prophets of the second half will be given satanic power. Satanic power to be able to do many signs and wonders, or deceive many. The seventh point is where he says, verse 26. If someone tells you the Messiah, ask him back to serve them, do not come out of hiding, because the second coming will not be like the first coming. But in verse 27, when the lightning flashes the sky, that's when you know how the wind is going to go. But the flash of lightning, the flash of lightning is seen everywhere. The second coming will be quite different. Now, he points out the next segment which we haven't gotten there yet, that when the second coming occurs, it will be quite visible to everybody. And then there's a bit of a question that comes up as the eighth part of verse 20. Verse 70, Carcass says there will be even so better brethren be vultures be gathered together. Now the exact emphasis of this we can see from a parallel passage. Go back to Luke chapter 17. Luke chapter 17. In Luke 17, from verse 22 on, he also gives some prophecies about the second coming. And in verse 27, they answer and say, attempt where, Lord? In other words, where will the second coming occur? They give sort of a cryptic answer. He said to them, where the body is, then it will be vultures or eagles, metamorphosis of penetration, will be gathered together. So go back with this background to the Matthew 24 passage. The body is the body of Israel, not yet regenerated. The vultures are the Gentile nations. And where the body of Israel is, where the vultures are coming together, that's where the second coming will occur. Here's a cryptic answer, presupposing certain elements of the Hebrew Bible. So, passage you can mark down, Micah chapter 2, verse 12 and 13, Micah 2, 12 and 13. He points out where the remnant will be adding. It'll be the city of Bozra, spelled in Hebrew and English, B-O-Z-R-A-H. B-O-Z-R-A-H, that's where the Jews will be adding. And Bozra today is better known by its Greek name as Petra. That's also be the place of the second coming in Isaiah 34, verses 1 through 7, Isaiah 34, verses 1 through 7, and Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6. Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6.